Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to another episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. We're talking on Thursday, February 22nd, and earlier this morning was a terrorist attack, fatal one, along the road between the community, the city of Ma'ale Adumim and Jerusalem, as a massive traffic jam took place just outside a checkpoint on their way, on people's way towards the city of Jerusalem. So we're going to talk a bit about that. We're going to talk about what the significance of these terrorist attacks are and the growing escalation that we're seeing in violence in places like the West Bank and the North, alongside, obviously, the war that continues in the Gaza Strip. Our interview today is with Oded Revivi, the mayor of the city of Efrat, what would be called the settlement, just to the south of Jerusalem. So we talked to him about everything that's going on in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria. And then I'm joined for a panel by Shmuel Rosner and Donna Luzon, two fellows from JPPI, for a talk at the wider aspects of all of these different elements and issues that are taking place in Israel. And of course, another round of hostage negotiations that's taking place in all of places. In Paris, for some reason, that's where everybody likes to go to negotiate a hostage and ceasefire deal. So here we go with the interview with Oded Revivi. Oded Revivi, thanks for joining us on the JPPI podcast. It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
So we're talking just a couple hours after another terrorist attack on a road at a military checkpoint, this time from Ma'ale Adumim towards Jerusalem. Very reminiscent of the attack just a few weeks ago at the Tzomet Amin Harot, what we call the tunnel, or the tunnel checkpoint, the tunnel junction that connects the road between Jerusalem and Efrat and Gush Etzion, where there was one person who was killed and several others wounded. You have come out very strongly and said that you've been warning about this, that this is these traffic jams at these crossings are really becoming a threatening and a huge challenge and a point of vulnerability for Israel. How do you see it?
Well, first of all, the two events are slightly different. The event that happened in our region was considered a success story because basically there was a group of terrorists who wanted to go into Jerusalem, and the checkpoint managed to identify them. And when they were identified, then they opened fire. They weren't intending to attack the checkpoint. But after that incident, and after it was reported as such a great success of eliminating a terror attack in the capital, I basically reminded all the heads of security forces that we've been warning for this for quite a few years, all documented in letters and in meetings, including a meeting that happened just less than a month ago in the Knesset, that the actual weak point is all the cars waiting in line to go through the checkpoint. And what happened this morning is basically the terrorists understood that, took advantage of cars standing in a roadblock for over a kilometer and a half. That's a very long distance. They just got out of the car and started shooting. And when you hear the first response team, the first aid people, the ambulance people, they basically said they couldn't get to the victims who were injured, and one was also killed because it was just one big traffic block. There are solutions for it. And when we had the meeting...
Like what? I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. What are the solutions?
So when we had the meeting on the 24th of January, it's less than a month ago, in the Knesset, the members of Knesset who summoned all the heads of the security departments were shocked as to the fact that one roadblock is really governed by four different organs, which means there isn't one united chain of command that you know who you're funding and what results you want out of them. The infrastructure, there's no question about it that it's not equipped for the amount of people that actually go through these checkpoints. But example, in our road, there are four lanes. For some odd reason, most of the day, only two are actually open, which means you're already created. Okay, so there is the infrastructure. Why not just open it? And then the other thing is, they're all designed professionally, i.e., if it's going traffic, they can just go straight. If they want to check a car, there is a way on the side to pull over and to be checked over there. For some odd reason, again, no cars are being checked on the side. All the cars are being checked on the actual lane where the cars need to go by, which again causes more and more traffic. And especially at times like this, when the ministers and the government are saying that they need to have more first response teams in the different towns and cities in Israel after what happened in the 7th of October, I told them, you're basically creating a new town of 300 cars, 500 cars, 1,000 cars, which are in a standstill with absolutely no security measurements, no way to protect themselves. And it's a disaster that's asking to happen. And unfortunately, this morning, it really happened.
I mean, you know, I'm wondering in Judea and Samaria, what some also call the West Bank, where Ephrat is and other so-called settlements are located, and you have surrounded by Palestinians and some of them hostile. Right. I know that you've worked very hard over the years. We've spoken about this many times to foster some, you know, as good as relationship as possible with some of your Palestinian neighbors in Ephrat, but not all communities in Judea and Samaria have those relationships. And the fear of an October 7th style attack against a settlement cannot be ignored. And I don't think that right now, I'm thinking of Ephrat, a place I know well. You don't have enough security around Ephrat if you have 100 armed terrorists who want to go into the community. I don't think any settlement has that today.
Well, if you want to carry on down that road, I would say no city in Israel has enough forces to protect itself. And we saw the outcome on the 7th of October. There is, at the end of the day, a limit and a borderline where my responsibility and my duty as a mayor lies and what the army, the police, or the government have to do. But I can tell you that Ephrat, for example, since the 7th of October, we've raised an enormous amount of money. We've raised over 10 million shekel, about $2.5 million, to improve our security system, which is extremely good the day before the 7th of October attack. But we took some of the lessons that we were taught by the brutal attack of the terrorists in the 7th of October and are preparing the city for an even worse scenario. Can I say to you, can I guarantee you, especially that this is recorded, that Ephrat is safe and we are absolutely protected from any threat? Obviously not. But as a mayor, I'm definitely trying to do everything in my power in order to make it a safer place than it was before.
I want to ask you, I mean, Oded, you've been in public service for a long time. If I recall correctly, you're also a lieutenant colonel in reserves, combat record and experience. How do you view just looking, and you know a lot of these players in the government, especially in the Likud party, how are you viewing overall the way the war has been going?
It's hard to examine and give advice and not being in the front line, not being in the rooms where the decisions are being made. We are all the wise guys who see it all from outside and have got the answers for everything. So I don't like putting myself in that position. I think generally speaking, the army with its maneuver have caused a lot of surprise for many Israelis. There were many skeptical people that thought that the forces on the ground won't be able to maneuver. They're not practiced for it. And I think at the end of the day, we saw quite an impressive maneuver and quite successful. I think the coordination that we saw between the Air Force, the intelligence, and the troops on the ground was also impressive. I'm not in a place that I can say it was done at the grade of 50% or 100% because I'm not quite involved in all the operations taking place. But I think that was a refreshing surprise, especially after the attack of the 7th of October. And I'm sure things will be examined, will be learned, and we'll see what needs to be.
And especially considering that there were so many people who were skeptical of whether the IDF is capable. And I totally agree that really they have thrown that out the window. I mean, that this army is really unbelievable in its capabilities. But I am curious, in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank, there's a lot of concern. And this terrorist attack is just another example that happened today near Male Adumim, of that under the surface, we might not see it every day, but it's there. And we see that the IDF is operating all the time. And Ramadan is starting on March 10th. And that's always a time of challenge and opportunity for Palestinian terrorist groups to rise up and try to do something. Are you worried specifically about this Ramadan that's coming?
I wouldn't say I'm worried. I am concerned any given day because I understand that things can happen any single day.
That's the modus operandi. Always be concerned.
Yeah, but you know, when we talk about Judea and Samaria and the war in the south. I think that is to the credit of the government and the army. They're doing things in Judea and Samaria that they haven't done for years. The amount of people that have been arrested because they're suspects or that they are in need for questioning and for interrogation and for information is beyond any numbers and figures that we knew in the past. The army is managing to do it relatively under the radar, not exposed, not receiving any criticism for how many operations they are actually doing. And it's obvious that these operations are keeping those who want to harm us on their toes because they see the amount of arrests, maneuvers that are being done in Judea and Samaria that are keeping them quite in check. And that's why they're not raising their heads at the moment.
One of the other issues that's come up recently regarding Judea and Samaria has been the sanctions and the executive order that President Biden signed and sanctions that have been imposed so far on four so-called settlers who live in the West Bank. One of them, I think, is actually under administrative detention in Israel. So he's already actually locked up for a period of time. There's reports that the Americans are planning additional sanctions. The French have done their sanctions. The British have done their sanctions. The way I kind of look at it is the gates have been opened, right? If for years we said, you know, we were worried about this happening, now under the war, they have decided to go down this road. So far, they're calling it after going after people who are engaged in what they call settler violence, which I completely throw out. It's obviously despicable that there is this violence sometimes, but to make a moral equivalency between fringe, sporadic, isolated criminals and what's happening with Hamas is, in my eyes, despicable also. But put that aside for a moment. The way I see it, look, we know that all these countries want a two-state solution. We know that all these countries don't like the fact that we are in Judea and Samaria. And they are kind of showing us that they're going to, that this could be the day after, could be somebody like you who gets sanctioned for being a so-called settler leader. How much of this do you think, are we really taking this seriously enough as a government, as a country? And are you, again, I hate to keep asking, are you concerned? But are you concerned also about where this is headed?
So here, I think the executive order is definitely something to be worried about, because I think the snowball has started rolling. The only way I see it taking a shift or turning around is with a new administration that will decide to call these executive orders void. And that's without my ability to interfere with the elections in the United States. But the way the Democratic Party is going, I can't see it stopping. And I can definitely see it being a snowball that's rolling down the mountain and growing larger and larger. And I think, again, I'm unaware of what the government is doing against the executive order. I think they woke up, if they are doing anything, they woke up a bit too late, because I can't see President Biden going back on what he's already signed. And the wording of the executive order is definitely very worrying. It definitely shows the ability of the administration to call for sanctions against a much larger group of people for various reasons, which can literally be just not liking a policy that I, as a mayor, am carrying out. I know it has infected already American donors who are considered that their money will be followed and will be traced, and they might be included in the list. And it's definitely something that I'm a bit disappointed with the administration going so far and doing it. And we saw that in no time, there were European countries who were just waiting for this first signal that they can join in, and they joined in. And, you know,
is the government here doing enough, do you think? I mean, you know, look, freezing people's bank accounts as a result of sanctions that are imposed by a foreign country. These people are not American or British or European citizens. They're Israeli citizens. The Israeli government does have responsibility towards its people.
I think it's more than that. And I don't know, again, what the government is actually doing against this executive order, and it's beyond my imagination what can they do once it was signed. But basically, the executive order is saying to the state of Israel, we don't think you're doing enough to enforce the law. Therefore, we're going to be the prosecutor, we're going to be the judge trialing these people, and we're also going to be the executors of the judgment. But there's just one thing. the private individuals that the sanctions are being taken against them didn't have their day in court. Their names were listed, and already there are punishments against these people. And that's the shocking thing, that you would think that all these countries that you mentioned call themselves democratic countries. All these countries believe in the rule of law. All these countries believe in a judicial system. Yet they're pointing at an ally country and saying, we don't trust your legal system, and therefore we're going to do something that is in your power, isn't in your power, but we're going to carry out the way we see it.
And how just banks here immediately freeze people's accounts, again, without that whole due process, is ridiculous in of itself. Odade, I want to thank you for joining us, especially because you are, what, just like 5 days before an election on Tuesday of next week. Efrat really is a remarkable city. And, for the last 15 years, and now it's at, what, about 10,000, 12,000 residents or something? Higher, 15,000? 15,000. Where was it 15 years ago?
8,000.
And plans, I've heard you talk about plans to grow to 40,000, 50,000 in the future.
All subject to the American administration allowing us to build.
Exactly. Well, Israel deciding whether to accept American dictates or not. But wishing you a lot of luck, Odade.
Thank you.
And batzlacha with the election and everything you do. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. All the best.
Okay, so that was an interesting interview with Odade, and kind of just following up on the aspect or this line of thought regarding the escalation that we're starting to see in the West Bank. Shmuel, I thought we'd start with you. You know, this is Ramadan is coming March 10th. Ramadan is always a time of great tension. Itamar Ben-Gvir and the government has already been able to push through, it seems so far, a decision that was taken that we're going to be limiting Israeli Arabs, not only Palestinians from the West Bank, who can go to the Temple Mount for prayer services there. That's something that's also probably going to lead to some more tension. I mean, is it possible that we are on the verge of another front that's even wider than what we see today?
Well, that's been the fear since the start of the war. We started in Gaza, then the north came along, and there was always a fear that a third front, you know, you could say that there's only a third front in Yemen. But let's leave Yemen aside, even though just this morning a missile was interrupted on its way to Israel. So Yemen is a front. And the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, that's always the potential for a much wider wave of violence is always there. And Israelis tried to contain it in all kinds of different ways. The decision to limit access to Temple Mount during Ramadan is aimed at achieving such level of containment. It's a controversial decision, we must say. The political leadership was more supportive of limiting the access. The security echelon was more in favor of somewhat relaxed rules concerning access. So we don't yet know what's going to come out of it. But the fear is there, the potential is there, the fuel is there. It's all up in the air.
As is often the case here. So Dana, I mean, you know, West Bank, obviously, I always think though that kind of the West Bank to some extent hits at the gut a bit more. I mean, you know, Gaza, obviously October 7th, and obviously what's happening in the north where you have so many evacuees, but also the West Bank. I mean, like, it's because of people living side by side, people driving on the same roads. There's no fence, even if, as we know now after October 7th, fences mean absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
But everybody is kind of just like merged together and mixed together, Palestinians and Jews and Israelis and everyone. And therefore, you never know where the attack is coming from. It's not coming from the other side of a fence. It could be coming from the car right next to you or the guy who's just walking down the street. So it does undermine a sense of security, everything that we're seeing, in a deeper way.
Yeah. After the October 7th, we know that what the terrorists that came into Israel was dreaming about is that the Palestinians and they had a dream that the Palestinians that live inside Israel also will join them. It didn't happen. And it didn't happen a week after, 2 weeks after, and 3 weeks after. It didn't happen. And I remember even writing an article saying that Hamas, the dream of Hamas didn't came true in that aspect, because they didn't join, and there was kind of a shock. Everyone was kind of a shocked, and I think they were also in kind of a shocked, because they didn't dream that Hamas will be so extreme. And I was thinking it was too extreme for them, even for them. But now I think, I'm not sure I can say that anymore. And even there were surveys taking place in Israel saying we don't emphasize with Hamas, we emphasize with Israel. But now I think this is not the situation. And what happened this morning really makes me feel that I'm starting to be afraid even to drive to Jerusalem to work. And to be honest, I don't feel I can say that the quiet will be as much as it was 2 weeks, 3 weeks after the war started.
Well, as somebody who's in Jerusalem as we speak, I can tell you we're okay for now. So, yeah. You know, feel free to come and visit. Everything will be fine.
I'm on my way. So,
and Shmuel's on his way. So if Shmuel's here, everything is definitely going to be okay. But Shmuel,
exactly.
Donna does touch upon an interesting point, and I know that you've been doing a lot of polling on this, and something that I've been thinking about, like, you know, after Shomer Chomot, Guardian of the Walls operation in 2021, we saw the riots in the mixed cities, in Akko, in Lod, in Ramlan, Haifa, and Bat Yam, Jaffa, you name it. It was all over the place. I think 4 people killed, 2 Jews, 2 Arabs, lynches. The assumption was in the army, even like the army won't drive on Road 6, Highway 6, because it could be blocked. So to move troops and tanks, and your generals were openly saying this, right? You know, we're again, like in a war, we're expecting 2 million people to rise up against us, referring to the Israeli Arabs. We're 137, 138 days or something like that into this war now. And that hasn't happened. There haven't been riots. Why is that?
Well, there are 2 possible reasons, and it's probably a combination of both. First of all, most Arab Israelis aren't supporters of Hamas. I think many of them were shocked by the atrocities that were seen on October 7th. And even though they might feel uncomfortable with the way Israel conducts the war in Gaza today, their tendency to move into this territory of supposedly joining in on something that was so horrific is not something that they wanted to do. That's one aspect. The other thing is fear. Look, both Israeli Arabs and Palestinians in the West Bank, they see what Israel is doing in Gaza. What Israel is doing in Gaza is, in a way, a testimony to the sentiment that now engulfs Israel. And people on the other side understand that that if you tickle Israel now, you put yourself in big danger, that Israel in his destructive mode, so to speak. And if you try to attack us now, we are going to respond with the full capabilities of our military, of our police force, etc. And I think that that's, at some level, people understand that this is not the right time to test Israel's patience. So for Israeli Arabs, it's probably a mix of both, a reluctance to support Hamas or to identify with anything that has to do with Hamas, and the sense that this is not a good time to test Israel, to test the majority of Israelis and Israel's police forces and military forces. For Palestinians in the West Bank, it's probably mostly the first reason, the fear. Mm-hmm. There is fear. Israel is now much more brutal in its response than what it used to do in previous years. In all previous operations, and you, Yaakov, you covered so many of these things, since this engagement in 2005, rounds and rounds of operations in Gaza, and there was always destruction. But what we see today is on a totally different level. And if you live in Nablus or in Ramallah or in other city, and you ask yourself, do I want this in my neighborhood? I guess the answer is probably no.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it's a combination of, I think, probably, sympathy and to some extent, they're not, they want quiet also, right? And they're also part of Israel, for good reason. But Dana, I mean, if following up on that point, you would expect, based on what Shmuel's saying and based on what we know, that a responsible government would seize this opportunity and say, wow, we actually can leverage what's happening now to better integrate Israeli Arabs into Israeli society, right? Do outreach. Get them more engaged. I'm not going to go as crazy as to say bring Mansour Abbas into the right wing coalition.
You were saying exactly what I was going to say.
Right, but I'm not going to go that far. But I mean, why is the government not doing something?
I don't know. They are not doing so many things I would expect them to do. So I'm not so surprised they're not doing that, because what after the October 7th, I remember that I was praying, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I was praying that some journalist or, some responsible people from the media will give the opportunity for the leaders from the Arab population to speak out. Mm-hmm. I will share a secret. I texted one of the heads of the news channels in Israel, and I said to them, listen, now the citizens of Israel need to know that they don't emphasize with Hamas. They want the quiet. They want to live with us, and they don't want to see those things, those pictures, those horrible events. They don't emphasize with this kind of a terror that Hamas did. And I was so happy that Mansour Abbas was talking on the news and saying, we don't emphasize with them. And I thought it was such an important thing to say. But since that minute, nothing happened. Nobody took it another step. They don't let them even come to the television and talk. And I think even the television and the media thinks we don't want to hear their voices. Like they avoid them. You don't even see the Arab journalists. Almost they don't talk. And I don't get it. I don't understand this kind of decision, because I think we are losing a very important time. Even the service said that the Arabs of Israel want to live with us on peace, and nobody takes it another step.
I think it's just another one of these missed opportunities that this government is going to be known for. I do want to touch upon, with the time left, about the talks that are supposed to take place on Friday, again in Paris, between the Israeli, Egyptian, American, and Qatari delegations. Another round of talks about whether we can find some deal to get back the hostages, maybe a ceasefire. The minister Benny Gantz, who's in the government, made some comments just the other day saying that it seems that there's been some progress.
You don't find it weird? Why Benny Gantz? And I was asking myself, why Benny Gantz was the one that coming to the television, to the citizens, two days ago or yesterday, mm-hmm. saying that there might be an option. Where is Bibi now? Why he's not the one who is?
So what's the answer?
Talking about you, I think I know the answer. I think my answer is that he doesn't want to collapse or to be in front Smotrich.
Mm-hmm. Well, he doesn't want to take a right wing position. Yes. That would right wing is, I hate saying that. because right-wing is not, you know, getting back the hostages doesn't mean that you're against hostages, although that is what Smotrich said.
Exactly. So I think this is why Gantz was the one to go front Israel and saying that. And I was, and that made me feel that even more, that what's going on is very politicized and I don't like it. I think this is wrong.
What are your thoughts, Shmuel, about the prospect of a deal here? Do you think that Netanyahu can go all the way with it?
Well, that depends on the deal. What we do have in Israel now is a debate that is out in the open. We somewhat contributed to this debate with our JPPI poll of last week. Yeah. When we discovered that, in fact, there is a majority in Israel who see the destruction or the annihilation of Hamas rule in Gaza as more important than the return of the refugees. It is true that the issue is much politicized, but it is also true that people are entitled to have different opinions on this issue, and that even within the government, there is a debate at some point when there is a concrete proposal on the table, they'll have to calculate the risk versus the reward. The reward meaning how many hostages we get back and for what, and the risk meaning what does this mean for the larger goal of the war, which is to get rid of Hamas rule. And I think that what we are going to see is that the more right-wing ministers in the government will tend to be more, more hawkish, more reluctant to have a deal if they think that the risk is high. And on the other hand, members of the Machane Mamlachti camp and you know, the more moderate ministers will say, well, if we can get the hostages back now, let's get them back and deal with Hamas later. Then again, the Israeli public, and this is a paradigm shift that we need to understand. It is a paradigm shift in Israel's way of thinking about the whole issue of hostages. It's not as if one day we were merciful and kind and the other day we became brutal and aggressive and unkind. Israel has a long history of decades in which it was willing to pay a very high price to get back hostages. It is no longer in that position. We were mugged by the reality of October 7th, and now Israelis feel that it is more important to fight the enemy, to destroy the enemy, to win the war, than to have the hostages back. It is a cruel conclusion, but it is what people feel today.
Yeah.
I saw the results of the survey that JPPI and Shmuel have shown us. And I must say, I think the results are very difficult to bear. And I think the results are the winning of the politicization, the winning of the bad framing of this war by this government. And I think that saying that Israel is less liberal now because what happened on October 7th and now our approach to the idea of hostages has been changed, I think this is something that for me is like saying, it's like Israel saying the hostages are going to pay the price for us changing our perception. And I think that if Israel wants to change her perception about hostages, do it after you are bringing them back. They don't need to pay this price. They don't need to bear
Dana,
this.
Dana, many soldiers are going to pay a heavy price.
I know.
Because Israel is determined to win the war.
I know.
Israelis
and
are
also
willing,
it's also difficult for me to bear that.
Israelis are willing to pay with blood.
Exactly.
Like never, well, not like never before, but in a way that we haven't seen for many decades. This is the first time that the Israeli government and the Israeli public are determined to win a war for whatever cost, in human life, in human blood, This is something that we need to understand. This is not the issue of the hostages cannot be separated from the overall picture and the overall change of perception in the way Israelis are looking at this region and at the challenges ahead.
And I think that that's the, you know, these dilemmas is what I always tell people is, you know, if we end the war, if the war ends with us eliminating, for example, Hamas leadership and not getting back the hostages, that would not be considered a victory. And if we get back the hostages, but we don't eliminate the Hamas leadership, that's also not a win. And I think that this dilemma, and this changes what a win is. It's not that we have to change what we can achieve. It's we have to change what the definition of victory is in this conflict. And that is something that changes the perception of how we view war, because we can't change, we can't manipulate reality. We can only achieve what's potentially possible. So we just have to change. When you look up victory in the dictionary, it's going to have to look a lot different. And instead of having leaders, I'm sorry, but instead of having leaders that talk about nitzachon mochetz, right, a complete victory, which is absurd and completely disconnected, we need leaders who are actually realistic and responsible and talk to us in that way. So,
and more honest.
Well, honesty is always a vital virtue.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.